Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and joined today by Dr. John Endres. John, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Always good to have you. And of course, we also have the wise and venerable Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
You're brown-nosing there, Nicholas, the wise man.
Now, I thought about sucking up more to John because he is, of course, my boss. But
you can't accurately call me doctor, though.
I suppose. All right. Anyway, with that out of the way, we are heading into a chilly but short week. So I hope that everyone at Gauteng is going to be bundling up for Thursday because it looks like it's going to be a little bit rough, the weather on that day. But at least it's a public holiday, so you can hopefully stay in bed for most of the day. Anyway, our first story today is some comments made by our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, about how to get the economy humming again. It has not hummed for quite some time, and so any suggestions are welcome. So let's evaluate what the president has said. The president recently spoke and said that the motor industry in South Africa is a prime example of the success of state assistance and that the state should play a more activist role in getting the economy working. He said that the state should be more active supporting sectors as it has done with the automotive sector. He cited the, quote, massive state support given to the automotive sector, which he says has now become one of the, what he called, crown jewels of South Africa's business capability as an example of what could be done. South Africa now exports vehicles to the rest of the world. He said the auto sector came to be what it is because it was supported and attracted many original equipment manufacturers from all over the world, largely on the back of support that government has given to the sector. Now, the News 24 piece on this, the Business Day piece on this, said that while it's not known precisely how much money has been given to the automotive sector, that it amounts to about somewhere between 6 to 20 billion rand in the last 9 years. Ramaphosa went on to say, I have been saying that government needs to be more activist. It needs to look at various other sectors that should be supported to retain and create jobs. The support measures could range from either tax holidays, subsidies, grants, research and development allowances, and all that. With this, we could move to another level of real economic growth. The auto sector sustains more than 170,000 jobs, but what has also yielded for us is the creation of other component manufacturers and a number of black players that are getting into that sector. Others have made the point who support the president on this that the automotive sector has created economic opportunities for sort of adjacent parts of the economy, not just the vehicle manufacturers themselves. So, John, let me start with you. What do you make of the president's suggestion here? Should government be looking at, I don't know what it might call, key or strategic sectors to subsidize to get the economy growing at a nice rate?
So I love the idea of getting the economy humming. I think that's exactly what it should be doing, which would improve all sorts of aspects of life in South Africa. But I do think that the president is wrong about the approach that he's proposing here, which is to use a very activist, interventionist approach on the side of the state. And the problem with this is that you are, in effect, keeping alive industries which are not necessarily meant to be alive. In other words, would we have a motor industry in South Africa if we were not pouring up to 20 billion rands into it over a period of years? The subsidy program has been going on now since 1995. I assume very strongly, and I believe this to have been the case in the past, that these automotive manufacturers would immediately close shop and leave our shores if they were not being bribed with subsidies to remain here. And then the question is, you know, should you really keep doing that? Is that a wise use of taxpayer money? I would argue it is not, because the subsidies that are paid to the automotive industries have to be taken out of taxpayers' pockets in the first place. So all of us living here in South Africa, through our taxes, are supporting this automotive industry, which is, I think, entirely composed of multinational companies, which benefit from these subsidies in the form of higher profits, which is good for Japanese and German shareholders, for example. But for South Africans, it's not so good because we end up having to pay higher taxes, firstly, And we also pay higher prices on cars because there are import tariffs on vehicles. There are restrictions on the importing of used vehicles. And that means that South Africa is limited to a very small market with pretty high prices. And I'm sure if you've ever looked at car prices overseas, be it in Germany, be it in Japan, be it in the United States, you'll be surprised at how much less cars cost over there than they do here. And why do they cost so much less? Because our prices are inflated because of the automotive industry policy. And it's a very good example, I think, of not thinking beyond the first order effects of a policy. The first order effects in this case are we have an automotive industry, we have employment, but the second order effects are, you know, what better outcomes are we preventing by keeping this industry alive, even though it is not per se profitable within South Africa? Nicholas.
So defenders of the subsidies will say, well, you know, look at how many jobs we're creating. We've got this 170,000 jobs in the motor industry, and then anywhere from 500,000 to a million jobs sort of indirectly connected to this industry. And so the subsidy has really done its work. Yeah, it's taking from the taxpayers, but it's all just taking from the rich. And really, this is the best way to create jobs. Terence, what do you make of that argument?
Well, you know, first of all, our automotive industry goes back, I think, to the 1920s. And Henry Ford visited what's then Port Elizabeth, now goes by a different name, in 1923. During the Second World War, a little a piece of trivia, we manufactured a lot of armored cars, Marmon Harringtons, that we used in Abyssinia, then in the desert. That gave a big shot in the arm. I think I'm probably somewhat more charitable to this idea than John. You know, at least we do have with those subsidies something that approaches competitiveness. We've seen things like the Mara smartphone plant that were launched with great fanfare collapsing. You know, we are plugged into a value chain, and I think that. If we want to rethink that, then you know, do understand that well-paying skilled jobs will go, and there will be a human cost for that. That would maybe not be such a problem if the economy as a whole was expanding and there were alternatives. But given the situation we're in, and John's quite correct. Apparently, vehicles manufactured in South Africa sell for less in Australia than they do, like in Pretoria. So, you know, you post the thing to Australia, presumably not using the post office, you end up with a cheaper car in Wagga Wagga. That being said, what concerns me here is the idea that this is something that can be replicated, and it's the exception that proves the rule. Now, here's the thing. Port Elizabeth, Nelson Mandela Bay was like the heart of South Africa's car industry for a long time. They've opened up prop plants elsewhere, and it's just reached day zero for water. So, you know, there's a misalignment of priorities and the inability to trade off. So the president says, well, you know, as you say, more tax subsidies. Okay, well, you know, does that mean that you're going to forgo taxes, that you need to roll out things like your national health insurance? I mean, this is, you know, you can't have everything. But, you know, say, more than this, a state that can't get water provision right, that can't keep roads functioning, we have massive bottlenecks in rail and port infrastructure. You know, that's, if we can't get that right, but, you know, you're going to trust the state to sort of intervene dexterously and, champion, I don't know, the latest flash drives or whatever for the world market. It's ridiculous. I've just published a piece looking at what we can learn from Indonesia and Vietnam, which actually came off something that the National Planning Commission said, like, what can we learn from Indonesia and Vietnam? So I'll answer it. These countries are not necessarily impeccably governed. There's probably more corruption in a place like Vietnam than there is in South Africa, but, you know, they also have a decent steady supply of electricity. You know, forget good governance. They've got good enough governance. You know, they've got a basket of opportunities. And, you know, what they do is okay. Now, we've got a much more complicated situation. We're far away from our markets. We're at the bottom end of a continent. We're not in a, you know, we're not in the kind of major shipping lanes that Vietnam and Indonesia are. We don't have the United States just sitting across the Pacific. You know, we can't necessarily reproduce that or reproduce what we did in our own history in the 1920s. You know, or in the Second World War, where there was this mad crush to get, put engines and steel boxes to go up and fight wars.
So, John, the last sort of point on this is, I think, you know, the question of, and kind of Terence sort of raised it here, of efficient spending, right? So, let's kind of take the middle figure here for how much has been spent on, you know, keeping these jobs alive over the last 9 years, sort of around 9 million rand, let's say 10 million rand. Sorry, 10 billion rand.
Million, billion.
This is right. This is always kind of difficult to quantify. But if we had spent that money differently, in the form of, I don't know, maybe tax breaks or something else, maybe more jobs would have been created. What do you make of that argument?
I'm sympathetic to that argument. That also reminds me of a comment made by the ANC's head of economic transformation, Ms. Kubai, recently, where she said that foreign investors must invest unconditionally in South Africa. And she was taken to task for that by the Center for Risk Analysis and also by Ismail Lagardin, writing in Business Day. He explained to her in very simple language that's not how investment decisions are made. They're always conditional. You know, you always want to know that you're going to get a return on your investment, that your investment is safe, it won't be stolen, it won't be expropriated. And if those conditions are not met, then you're probably not going to put money down. So ultimately, this is really where the government needs to start if it wants to promote investment. It really needs to roll out the red carpet to the investors and say, you know, your investment is very valuable to us. We appreciate your confidence in investing in South Africa. We'll make sure that nothing happens to your investment. We'll make sure that you can earn some decent money and, you know, please come here, invest with us. But rather don't do it through subsidies. So don't pay the people to come here. Give them a tax break by all means. Give them useful access to infrastructure, protect their investments, and then, you know, then they should come. It also reminds me that the president was speaking only about the motor industry as an example of a subsidized successful industry, but he wanted to roll out this model across other parts of the economy. However, South Africa is broke. So, you know, where's the money going to come from for those subsidies? So I think he was dreaming a little bit. It was of the nature of bullet trains and smart cities. Subsidizing swathes of the economy to attract more investment, I think, is really wishful thinking. Nicholas?
Terence, just on your point there about the advantageous position of Indonesia as compared to us, I did actually just quickly do a little measurement on Google Maps, and Cape Town is closer to New York than Jakarta is to Los Angeles. So perhaps an argument could be made we actually have the better port position for exporting.
You know, possibly, but I think, but you know, like as I say, it's
how these
things stack up.
I know there's routes and things.
If lots of ships are going through there anyway, it's going to be cheaper. I mean, well, one of the problems we have is just how long it takes to clear a ship through. Through you know Durban or Richards Bay, you know you do it much faster in Indonesia or in Vietnam. Look, you know, I just to talk about your question directly now, if we'd put this money elsewhere, my fear is that given the general state of things, we'd probably just have ended up with no automotive industry and nothing else.
So possibly. Although I'm sure the whiskey industry probably, or at least the foreign whiskey industry probably would have benefited from that 10 billion if it'd be put.
Yeah. And I see one of our viewers had a grandpa who was a driver and a mom in Harrington. My grandpa was also up north, Abyssinia Desert and Italy. Although I don't think he was an armor. He was an infantryman.
The Daily French Show. Come for the political and economic analysis. Stay for the World War II history. I think maybe that should be our catchphrase. Anyway, So we're going to move on to our next story now. And our next story, Terence has already preempted a little bit earlier. And this is in Gqeberha, Nelson Mandela Bay Municipality, formerly PE, where it looks like the municipality is pretty much on, well, the headlines call it day zero, but, you know, what even is day zero? And this being in terms of water availability. So according to news reports that came out in the last couple of hours, one of the main dams, the Mpofu Dam near Nelson Mandela Bay, has officially dropped so low that no more water could be extracted from it. There is the next dam is the Churchill Dam, which is only at 9% capacity. And there's the fullest dam they have is the Groenendaal Dam, which has water to last PE an estimated 168 days. But who knows if that's going to be the case. A message from the municipality read, residents are cautioned that the bulk water supply is vulnerable since no water can be extracted from the Mpofu Dam because it is too low. Only Churchill provides water, which is insufficient and is currently being supplemented by over-extraction from Loree Dam. This is merely a temporary solution and water will have to be reduced again as of Monday. As a result, we urge residents to use water sparingly. Gift of the Givers, the charity organization, has apparently dispatched a team to the municipality, they say, to drill for water. Their operations manager said some sites have been identified for boreholes and drilling would start as soon as the teams had arrived. And once the water is found, they would test it to see whether it was clean enough to be connected to the city's water supply to hopefully subsidize it a bit. This is not the first time this has happened to a major South African city, although it is the first time I think that day zero, so to speak, has officially been reached. But of course, we know that Cape Town struggled with water for a long time. And there were complaints laid at the municipality there, but there were also a lot of complaints put at the feet of national government, that national government had not invested enough in the dam building and the sort of larger problems of water supply in the country. So I'm sure you could probably, there's probably multiple levels of government from national to provincial to municipal that can have the finger pointed at them. But John, what do you make of the story?
Well, I think it's a story about the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro itself, but it's also a story about the rest of South Africa. And, you know, it just fits into that broader narrative of the water problems that we currently face and that we are heading towards in the future. And, you know, any number of experts has warned us about this. And I think rightly so, that South Africa is not a country abundantly blessed with water. It's a pretty dry country. And that means that we have to take good care of our water, you know, not waste it, make sure that it is properly treated before it is discharged back into the rivers. Make sure that dams are in place to provide water when the rain doesn't fall. And I think that in the case of Cape Town, we saw a little bit of that tension between the national government and the provincial and local government, because I believe bulk water supply is a national competency, and the bulk water wasn't being supplied to Cape Town, or the provisions weren't being made to increase the supply. And I suspect that something similar is going on in Nelson Mandela Bay as well, that you know, the dams are dropping lower and lower, as they've been doing now for how long? 5 years? That's long, several years at least. But we're not seeing really any urgency, I think, in the response of government to do something about that. And inevitably, you know, if you can see a problem heading your way and you don't do anything about it, then one day the problem is going to arrive and it'll be on your doorstep, and then you'll, you know, you'll have to worry. You'll have to be very concerned about what to do next. And in this case, what is the next step? Well, we've got a private charity coming in, trying to save the day. But that's going to be challenging because, you know, it's a large city. It's a large area. And drilling boreholes is almost like a stopgap measure. It's very much a last ditch of defense against the situation the city finds itself in now. Nicholas.
Yeah. So I see one of our commenters here, and I put it on the screen on the YouTube for the YouTube viewers. You know, there's been a tendency, I think, amongst a lot of sort of kind of armchair analysts and sort of government officials to say, oh, well, you know, this is the effects of climate change. And, you know, the country is really beginning to feel the effects of that. But I think, you know, regardless of how much that is true, and I think that the jury is still out on how much something like climate change is contributing to some of these problems. When you see a problem coming down the line, as you say, you kind of you have to do something about it. And it's not clear that you know, that kind of stuff has happened. And I think this really is an issue in South African governance as a whole, is that we're really not that great at long-term planning, unless the plans are so far away that they can be vaguely ignored for a long time, like the National Development Plan, which had all of its goals set for 2030, and then suddenly, oh, well, actually, maybe it needs to be 2035, because we're probably not going to reach it. Terence, where do you make all this?
Yeah, well, on the planning issue and seeing these things coming, I can tell you carte blanche. Ran a documentary which was online for a long time. I did look for it some time ago and I couldn't find it, so maybe it's been removed, about the water issue. And this was in about 2008. And I remember they said Mike Miller, who was, he was a proper scientist, but he had also worked in the post 1994 administration. He was the director general of water affairs for a while. He said it's time to panic. I remember Anthony Turton writing for the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. He ended up getting chucked out because of that paper. And I read it, and there was nothing that was contentious. I mean, he says yes, climate change, et cetera, all of the stuff. He's not skeptical about it. These are real problems, but Australia is also a water stressed country, and the Australians are making plans for it. He says that,
and of course, most famously Israel, but the government is not particularly keen on doing business with them.
Well, yeah, no, we'd rather dip into the renowned Iranian water technology, apparently, or the Cuban stuff. Look, as far as keeping your antiquated systems going, apparently the Cubans are very good at that. John speaks Spanish. I don't. We can invite the Cubans in if they know what they're doing. But that's beside the point. And I also remember, I think it was Lindiwe Sisulu saying shortly before the World Cup, he was asked on TV, do we have a water crisis? No, we don't. And I remember all of these plans and, they got mired in corruption. You know, this is an infrastructural breakdown, and not just on the government, on the governance level. I remember authoring an article in 2009. And I pointed out that South Africa could well face the same issues with water as we're now facing with electricity. And one of the peer reviewers said, well, I think this is alarmist, but anyway. A couple of years later, I was able to send her a note saying, I just wanted to remind you of this. I was being very mean-spirited. But, yeah, we needed to take this stuff seriously. Back in the 1990s, Joburg was already losing something like a quarter to a third of its water, just leaks. This is like the steam train that you've not only been hearing coming, you've been sort of watching it, and it's now a couple of millimeters away from your face, and you start to say the OSH, and we all know how that one ends.
No, indeed, and I think bringing up the municipal leaks, so that's a good point about how sort of all of these problems kind of interconnect into each other. So bad governance at a municipal level and bad infrastructure maintenance leads to water leaks, which means that more water is needed. It just stresses everything. So the moment you have a crisis like a drought or something else like that, then you immediately enter some dangerous waters, so to speak. John, any final thoughts on this?
Well, maybe just the point that some statistics were recently published about the quality of water in Etiquini, Durban, at the point where the rivers enter the sea. E. coli concentrations there, I think if it's above 400, it's considered to be critical and dangerous. And several of those samples were at 40,000 or 160,000. It's completely crazy. But yeah, and also seeing some of the comments here in the chat about Cape Town having had enough dams. I think that's true. Sometimes you do face a 1 in 100 years or 1 in 1,000 years crisis. But you want your preparations to be the maximum that they can be. Do as much as you can to prepare for that, to deal with it, which I think Cape Town did, and which I think PE isn't doing.
Look, if I can just bolt something on there, I'm old enough to remember the drought in the early 80s, 1982, 83, I think, growing up in northern, what was then Natal, now KZN. And I remember that the water actually did run out. And water supplies were redirected from the mines. I remember you could kind of use it for bathing, but it shouldn't go through your geyser. You could sort of fill up a tub and then heat it with an immersion heater. They had water tankers that would come, and you would have to stand in line and get your. So you know we've been here before. It's you know there are problems which are beyond the scope of planning quite correctly, but it does stagger me that for all of the concerns about climate change and about the prominence of environmental thinking over the last 30 years, we are where we are. You know, surely we should have been taking the stewardship of our water resources that much more seriously.
No, well said. All right, so we've only got about 4 minutes or so to do the last one, but I think we can still get through it. And anyone watching Parliament last week would have seen that before President Ramaphosa was due to address Parliament, that the EFF said that they were not going to allow him to speak. And so they raised many spurious points of order, both because Parliament remains in this sort of hybrid mode where it's half online, half in person. Both in the House and via the online platforms, they raised lots of spurious points of information. This went on for 3 hours. There was lots of shouting and fighting and disruptions. And eventually, I think the EFF members on the platforms got muted. And the ones in the House were physically thrown out by the Parliamentary Protection Services. Parliament has now issued a notice, a statement rather, apologizing to the public for what it called distasteful scenes after the budget debate sittings descended into chaos as the EFF members were dragged out. Speaker of the National Assembly condemns in the strongest terms the conduct of MPs, particularly those of the EFF, for their disregard of the rules, the decorum of the House, and the authority of the Speaker as provided for in the rules of the House, Parliament said. Through their conduct, the EFF MPs also disrupted and interfered with the rights of the rest of MPs to participate and hold the President to account regarding how his department has spent previous budget and will implement programs that will improve the socioeconomic situation in the country, including the fight against the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequality, which affect the lives of many South Africans. Criminal charges, which include assault and intimidation, are being opened by staff members against responsible EFF MPs. Parliament is providing the necessary support for members of its staff. The EFF returned with allegations saying that that Parliament had inflicted gender-based violence on some of its MPs in the way they were handled by the protection services. Parliament responded, they will be looked into the conduct of members involved with a view to determine whether any further action should be taken. So, bit of a mess. It's not the first time we've seen this happen to the EFF. And I must say, I think this is possibly the strongest rebuke I have ever seen from Parliament with regards to the EFF's behavior, which is an interesting point in of itself. But the thesis I want to really talk about here today is this idea that through actions like this, like preventing the president from being able to speak because of these criminal charges circulating around him now, laid by Asha Frazier, I've run into quite a few South Africans who look at this and say, you see, this shows that the EFF are the real leaders of the opposition because they are not afraid to break the rules in order to oppose the ANC as hard as possible. They are the most, they are, to quote, to sort of paraphrase Osama bin Laden, the strong horse. They are the opposition party, which really goes out there and, as many Donald Trump supporters once said, they fight, he fights, is said about Malema. Terence, what do you make of that argument? I suspect that that there is a lot of resonance of this idea around at least some EFF supporters. Is it a reasonable thing? What do you think?
I think we have an interesting phenomenon in our political culture where our elites, let's say your MPs, your commentators or whatever, have an ideological orientation that is not reflected by those in whose name they claim to speak. Our own polling, you know, that's looked at what the supporters of political parties think, for instance, show that there's not much congruence between what EFF supporters feel and what their party's platform is. But I think fundamentally, this is the Osama bin Laden principle. If you show me a weak horse and a strong horse, I'll bet on the strong horse. And I think that that so much of our politics has been centered around the ANC that we've kind of fetished the idea of opposition. And the guys who are giving the ANC, you know, a blood nose, that's enormously attractive. But you know, the disrespect to institutions and that sort of thing, I shudder to think where this ends up.
John, your thoughts?
Very briefly. I think we've run out of time pretty much. But I think, you know, what you also have to look at is that we have been in a one-party dominant system for such a long time. And I do think that, you know, many opposition MPs for the longest time have been doing their jobs according to the parliamentary rules to very little effect. You know, you've got your questions, you're trying to hold ministers to account, but nothing happens. And you sort of wonder, you know, what's the point? You try to make input into the lawmaking process, get ignored because you're in such a small minority, because the ANC is so dominant, you get ignored and you're worried about that. And then to have the EFF come in and sort of with a crowbar break that dominance, I think is refreshing to many people. And in a sense, you know, you'll welcome it and you say, at last, you know, the ANC is having to respond. In fact, and it can't hide behind the rules any longer. But the problem is the long-term damage that this can do to the institution. In other words, you know, if you once start chucking MPs out physically or MPs fighting each other in parliament, the rules being abused and so on, then it makes parliament less effective in the long term. So that's the risk there. Nicholas.
Definitely. All right, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Fringe Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.